Professor Kessler, Torts Class, November 20th, podcast number 2 in room number 308.
Marcella, this one, pass it around. Yeah. Right. Tell people things are ugly as they come in. So, make it faster. Yes, let's do it now.
Yeah. Who needs an evaluation and a pencil?
Yes, I have all my.
Thank you.
Here's one.
You could use one? Okay.
Yes. Okay. All right, David. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one. like someone saying this was a witness to the
products liability. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Are we going to cover the economic loss
doctrine? No, not per se. So, well, no, you, oh, wait a minute. Oh, of course. That's, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the economic theory. No, you mean the Seeley case. Ford versus Seeley, absolutely. No other questions? Yes, sir. Ma'am. Wrong way. Can't hear you. I believe that we have one class next week and the last class. Correct. And I'm going to try to save time during the last class for questions or review or some such, but now that I find the test is the 15th, unlikely you will have studied that weekend, but we'll do what we can. So, back to product liability. And there's no question about what we covered. Yes?
For the review, it's just question and answers. You're not going to go through any sort of cumulative review.
Correct. Okay, that's right. You're supposed to be doing a cumulative review.
I am.
Good. Okay, now, in terms of product liability, last time I spent half an hour or so talking about, if you will, the background, the kind of factors that led to substantial changes in the legal system, and this is an enormous change in the legal system, controlling the duties of manufacturers in regard to their manufacture, design, and distribution of products. Now, the first question is a limiting question. What does this new obligation apply to? What does it apply to? And when I say what does it apply to, the question is, a lot of people do things that aren't simple. And what I mean by that is, some people make a product, and it goes out the door of the factory, and it gets sold, period. But other people buy a product and use that product in providing services to the consumers. For instance, if you go to a restaurant to have a meal, you buy food, but the food that you buy is food that the restaurant bought and changed in some way. I mean, in the minor way, maybe they chopped up lettuce and the like to make a salad, but most of the stuff is cooked, is processed, is in some way worked on. And then, because, of course, we tend to have nice little tables and you sit there, there are things like knives and forks and spoons and glasses and plates that you use in the restaurant as part of the process of consuming the products that you're purchasing. So the food you purchase goes inside you, but the other products are used. If you pick up a glass that's filled with water, and in some bizarre way the glass breaks, and everybody, you know, doesn't act perfectly, instead of going, ooh, it broke, as it starts to break, you go, and you lacerate the nerves, causing serious injury, can you sue the manufacturer of the glass? Sure, no problem. Because we've decided by this time that the manufacturer is liable to the ultimate consumer, right? Been there, done that. There's a problem, however. Anybody ever worked in a restaurant? What do the glasses look like? I mean, the different glasses. You buy some glasses, after a while some of them break, correct? You got to buy new glasses, right? They look just like the old glasses? You try to. Where did you buy the first ones, the second ones, the third ones, if you've been in business for 15 years? Where did the glasses come from? Who made the glasses?
Walmart.
What? They tend not to have identifying information on the glass either. So you can't tell. So terrific. I got my that banged up hand that doesn't work so well, and I can sue the manufacturer, but golly gee whip, I can't find the manufacturer. So how about suing the restaurant? That sounds good, right? I can sue the restaurant. Well, of course, it's absolutely clear. I can sue the restaurant in what tort? Just shout it out. Everybody knows. What's the obvious tort I can sue the restaurant in if I can make out the elements? What? Negligence. Absolutely. Except there's a little problem in suing it in negligence. That is, I haven't told you anything to suggest that they were negligent. Right? I mean, the glass, I didn't say there's a big crack in it or something like that. The glass broke. What can they do? Ooh, how about non-delegable duty? You can't, right? problem is this isn't something that any kind of heightened danger. If they have a non-delegable duty as to making sure glasses don't break when you pick them up, then there is no negligence law anymore. Everything has been subsumed. And the non-delegable duty concept of res ipsa essentially applies to a limited area of activities, all in which have that same dynamic of an enormous amount of danger, and the individual can't protect themselves, like escalators and things like that, can't protect themselves from it, and therefore we're completely relying on someone else, and it has to be the Port Authority, the train, not someone you delegate. So, I mean, classes, that's not going to work. So you're left with, can I do strict liability in products? And I say, oops, maybe I can't. Aaron Wright, why maybe I can't? Why maybe I can't sue the restaurant in strict liability in products? Or somebody else. Aaron already told us what the problem is. What's the problem? Well, notice the case in the first, if you will, in the first part of this has to do with the distinction between a sale and a service. That's the next one. I'm sorry, I anticipated you. A sale or a service. And the question is, this is Kafazu, by the way, it's the next game. Sorry, Aaron. Sale or service. And the product liability tort is limited to situations in which a product is being sold. That is, it's a seller. A seller is the person who has this special obligation. Well, the question is, did the restaurant sell you the glass? No. That actually is a no case, and one court did find that you can sue the restaurant, but that seems bizarre. There is a distinction between the service that you get and the products that are used to facilitate the service. And the restaurant is selling you the food. It's not selling you the plates and the glasses and the knives and forks. And the general consensus, therefore, is that if you're not buying the item, then the item is being used to provide you with a service, and therefore the person providing the service is not strictly liable. Now, sometimes, as in the transfusion cases, you have a scenario in which there is a more difficulty in deciding what's going on. You see, I gave you the easiest one, even though there's that no case with the glass, which I think is wrong. The easy one, they keep the plate, they keep the glass, they keep the knives, you go out with the food. So, I mean, it's very easy to distinguish there between the use of the product and a service activity. But what happens if it is a transfusion in a hospital? I mean, are they selling you the blood? Well, you go out with the blood. I mean, you didn't come in with the blood, you go out with the blood. So this is distinguishable, right? It's distinguishable from the knife, fork, and spoon, which they keep all the time. But the hospitals made an argument that this was really a service of medical treatment, and they weren't thus selling blood. They were in the service business, and the blood, if you will, was an accoutrement, something necessary for the service, and therefore they shouldn't be looked as sellers of things. They should be looked at as providers of service. Right? Provider of service, no strict liability, only negligence. If you are a seller, then you have an obligation to guarantee or warranty the suitability of the thing you sell for use. And that's a strict liability. It's a guarantee of usability. Yeah?
Does this apply only to the particular person who bought the product, or someone who's using the product as well? Like, say you're a wedding or a bar mitzvah, and you eat their food, but you didn't buy that food, you didn't
No, the strict liability tort has now been extended. If you take a look at the three alternatives of the UCC that are presented on page 745, the broadest version of what could have been the rule as it was being developed in the 1960s has become the rule, which is anybody affected by the product. So, you know, if the product blows up and you're just nearby and you weren't even using it or knew that anybody was using it, the manufacturer's responsible to you. So, we've gone beyond those initial potential limitations as to the responsibility or duty of the manufacturer. So, if it's a service, no strict liability. If it's a sale, yes. And I told you, the blood was a problem, and it was a real problem, by the way, when these cases developed, because of the inability at the time for hospitals to know whether or not the blood was contaminated, either by hepatitis or AIDS. Yeah. Well, but here is what happened. Let me answer that question as I was. And if I don't give you a good enough answer, let me know, and I'll try again. At a period in time, people knew there was hepatitis, and then they knew there was HIV virus, and hospitals, of course, were busily giving people transfusions. But there really wasn't any way for a number of years to tell whether the blood was contaminated or not. Then there began to be ways to screen the blood, but initially there wasn't. Remember, I mean, everybody didn't just wake up one day and say, oh, we now understand everything about HIV that we do today. You know, on June 4th, 1983, we knew it all. And it took a long time. So you couldn't sue the hospital for negligence for giving you contaminated blood, because they'd done whatever it was they could do. So the plaintiffs then tried to impose strict liability. And that is, we bought blood from the hospital. That blood was contaminated. Therefore, the hospital sold me a product that was not fit for reasonable use. And since strict liability involves that the seller warrants, guarantees that the product is going to be reasonably safe for use, they violated their obligation. And it doesn't matter, remember, what the intent is. The focus is on the product. Well, the blood is contaminated, therefore it wasn't fit for its use. Therefore, they should be liable. And the cases like Cafazo, which is a very recent case, dealing with a somewhat different issue, is what we now have instead of those earlier cases. Many of those early cases decided, by the way, that blood was a service. And then, I think, as it became clear that you could test the blood and tell, then all of a sudden the court noticed that the hospital bill charges you for the blood. Actually pay more for the units of blood you got. Well, now you probably get paid for each tissue you use. But they pay for the blood, and then they decide, well, you know, it's really a sale of a product. However, at this point, it doesn't matter because they can test the blood and check the blood, so they would be negligent not to. Now, in terms of this sale or service issue, that's the kind of scenario in which it develops, but it has a particular impact because the next thing to realize is that when we say strict liability in product, we tend to think of the manufacturer of the product, General Motors, who lets the car go out the door. And then in some way the car has a defect, a problem, which makes it not safe for the normal and anticipated use, and therefore we sue the manufacturer. But this strict liability idea has historical antecedents. And that's why I've started to call it a warranty, correct? Well, a warranty is something in contractual law
that you get from the person from whom you bought a product. It's from the seller. It's not from the manufacturer. It's from the seller. You buy it with a warranty.
Now, nowadays, warranties are extraordinarily limited, and, you know, if in fact this does not work, you can come back and we will say we are sorry, and we have no economic loss for anything else, and if we don't say we're sorry, that doesn't matter anyway, because we looked in your direction or something like that. But it comes with a warranty. And the idea of this strict liability, in one sense, develops from the warranty, the guarantee of suitability for the intended use, that historically flowed from the seller to the immediate buyer, remember, in that privity construct. Well, now that we've expanded the liability so that the seller is liable to the ultimate user, not just the person with whom he or it contracted, and they're liable to incidental people, that is, people who happen to be around who got injured, or users who never bought it at all, we haven't stepped back and say, wait a minute, why should the seller be liable now? In other words, why should the retailer be liable? Because once we identify the reasons to make manufacturers liable to the ultimate consumer, which is that the ultimate consumer has no ability to check or determine safety in any possible way and therefore relies on the manufacturer, the retailer is in the same position. What can the retailer do? Yeah? Oh, that's right. In theory, they can decide not to purchase the product. And indeed, Walmart can. But if you have a small appliance store, you know, I don't carry Black & Decker, you know, very hard if you are a small store, because the nature of the economic relationship is that in most circumstances, retailers do not have enormous leverage. In most cases, the manufacturers do. Now, of course, that's not true with small manufacturers, but in the norm, the retailers really don't have much choice. And they certainly can't do anything about it. It comes shrink-wrapped, remember, it comes in plastic, it comes sealed, it comes in such a way that the consumer knows it hasn't been opened. So very hard for retailers to do anything. Now, theoretically, they can, right? That's a good theory. But in practice, it's very hard for them to do anything about it. And I always like, just when you think about it, I mean, let's say that there's some real labor problems at this factory. And as a result, the workers are unhappy. So they do a variety of job actions. They come in late. They call in sick. They follow the rules. But we've got one guy who's really very, very upset. So he sort of sabotages the products. So what he does is he brings, it's like a little pin with him, and he puts pinholes in this product that they're making. And the product, after it's made, gets folded and rolled and put in little cellophane and then put in a sort of a metallic-looking item and then puts in a box and then is all wrapped up. And, you know, it isn't likely that the retailer is going to open those packages and blow the thing up to see if the condom leaks air. I mean, there's nothing they can do. And you can say, oh, no, we don't handle Trojans. They had a strike 3 or 4 years ago, so I don't carry that product. I mean, you don't have any choice. So, I mean, I really think you have to view the retailer in most of these circumstances as being in exactly the same position as the ultimate user. But they're still liable. Why? Two reasons. Number one, they always were liable. Correct? So why change anything? Number two, remember the glass manufacturer we couldn't find in my prior hypo? Well, sometimes you can find the manufacturer, but they're out of business. So the retailer gives you another deep pocket, that is, another loss spreader. Remember one economic theory of why it's a good idea to make people liable who manufacture and distribute products rather than let the person who got the injury essentially walk around uncompensated is that injured people can't spread the loss. Whereas the commercial activities, the retailers, the manufacturers, can spread the loss among all of the customers. And therefore it's less big and less noticeable. Yes? They always were. I mean, you know, the retailer was liable in 1812 for this idea, that the product had to be suitable for the intended use. So now they're liable. Why shouldn't they be? In other words, they always were. And the intellectual construct of this is that the seller is providing this warranty, this guarantee of usability to the purchaser. And you buy it from whom? The retailer. So it's sort of hard to change. So that's this sales service distinction. But the point, the book points out that some particular retailers are in a different position, as in the pharmacist who is filling a prescription for a prescription pharmaceutical product. And this is discussed on 768, starting on 767 a little bit. And the point here is that California specifically exempts pharmacy from strict liability when they are distributing a prescription product. And the reason, by the way, is that now there is a difference. Because in this case, the pharmacist literally has no choice. I mean, the pharmacist can't change the prescription that the doctor orders. And we'll see about warnings later on. Now, next thing, hypo. this is just names for names. Jessica over here. With Jessica? No, Jessica? Yeah, Jessica. you're carrying an item for Mulray, which happens to be a little Degas statue. Right? And even in a declining economy, it's worth about $1.5 million. And, you know, you're carrying it along because it has to go someplace. And people are so artistically illiterate that you folks have decided it's safe to walk down the street with it because no one's going to recognize how valuable it is, and therefore no one's likely to attack you. So you just, you know, tuck it under your arm, walk away. But it just so happens that Pat, right, Pat over here, Pat is on a ladder, and he's fixing the roof. And as part of what he's doing, he's carrying a very large package of roofing tiles up the ladder on his shoulder. And because of a problem in the ladder, which we'll get to eventually, he loses his balance and lets go of the roofing material so that he doesn't fall. And at this point, you just happened, I don't know why, but instead of having it under your arm, you're sort of holding it here, looking at it a little bit while you're walking, sort of sideways, and this heavy, heavy thing of roofing material comes down, boom, right in between your hands, doesn't touch you, but completely shatters the statue. I mean, you know, powder totally destroys this thing. Now, of course, it was your fault, right? And you're not hurt in the least. But John is not happy at all. Right? Out over $1 million. And you expected it to go way up, too. So you have an investment loss, financial opportunity. So you're really, really unhappy. So you figure you're going to sue. And it just so happens that Pat was working for a large construction company. Remember Spondiat Superior? They have lots and lots of money. So you sue. But it turns out he fell because of a problem in the ladder, which no one could tell, and the ladder company is bankrupt for our purposes. Can't sue them. But even if they had a lot of money, even if the ladder had a lot of money, they would have a viable defense, maybe. They would be able to defend. And they would say that since there's no physical injury, you can't sue in strict liability Because
now, Aaron.
Because of the economic laws doctrine. And there is this doctrine that when the damages are only economic loss, you can't use strict liability. You have to sue in negligence. And we'll just assume in this case nobody was negligent. Let's make the latter company have lots of money too. But no one was negligent. What about this strict? What about this strict liability exemption for economic loss?
Well, here's the idea. The idea of it is, I buy a house, I buy a car, and I expect certain things, and I paid for certain things, and we had a contractual relationship, and the relationship had conditions, and it had limitations. And I paid the amount of money I paid because I got certain benefits. Well, the economic loss doctrine says that if you sought economic benefits, like a car that worked, and you paid a certain amount of money for the economic benefit of a car that works, if the car stops working, it's a contractual matter. And the question would be, did the manufacturer, did the retailer, did the person from whom you bought the product give you a product that conformed to that which you paid for? And if you didn't pay for an extended warranty, right, if you didn't pay for a warranty that it would continue working for the next 8 years, if it stops working 8 years from the time you bought it, you should not be able to circumvent this by suing in strict liability. By the way, why do people want to sue in strict liability, and why would this circumvent the contractual right? Well, statute of limitations differences. The statute of limitations for the strict liability we're talking about, and indeed for most personal injuries, flow from the time of the injury, not the time from the purchase of the product. Whereas contractual litigation has to come within a 6-year period, usually, from the date of purchase of the product. So the product can work just fine for 8, 9, 10 years. You can't sue the violation of contract. And then a problem occurs, and you say, well, okay, I want to bring a personal injury action in strict liability, and I want to do this, and I'm not time barred because the date starts from the discovery of the defect, which in this case would, of course, be when you're injured. And so the question about whether you're able to sue it is looked at by the system as whether or not you are circumventing the contract, which could have had protection forever, but you chose not to pay for protection forever, and therefore you shouldn't be able to sue. Now, the question becomes, is this like a Ford, Sealy versus Ford Motor, where the car blows up, or is this like these turbines that stop working in the cases discussed near Casa Clara, where there's a construction contract and the steel inserts didn't work, and there are similar cases where big electric generators in power plants stop working. That's East River that's referred to on 756 and 757. What's the nature of this limitation? Well, there are two ways it's looked at. First is that it is an exemption for property damage. And it doesn't apply to personal injuries. So, if for some reason your Ford pickup truck blows up, but it was in the middle of a field and no one was near it and no one got hurt,
you only can sue under contract, you cannot sue in strict liability. Under this theory, however, if somebody is hurt, well, then the person who is hurt can bring a strict liability tort. Why? Because it's not economic loss. The other theory is that if the car blows up and no one's hurt, that is a kind of event that could have hurt somebody. And it's very different from the car just not starting one morning because the motor froze or the turbine's not working and therefore you can't have electricity. That is flaws that cause the destruction of the purchased item itself, but in a way causing no potential for injury to anybody else. And under this theory, if there's a potential for injury to somebody else, then you can sue for strict liability, even though you're just recovering the value of the product. That is, your economic loss. All right? Now, either way, if you apply this to John's statue, it doesn't apply, correct? Because we're not talking about inability to sue for economic loss. What we're talking about is inability to sue for the economic loss occasioned by you are not getting what you expected. That is, you're suing the manufacturer of the product that you bought. You're suing the person with whom you dealt, and in that case, if your loss is only economic, you can't sue in strict liability. But when the loss is to a third party, that's entirely different. So my hypo lets us discuss that, but exceeds the scope of this doctrine, and therefore John can sue, and is very happy about it. Question? Now, talked about this mental state idea, and when focusing on the next little topic here of strict liability, this is the manufacturing or production defect tort. The manufacturing or production defect tort. Now, in dealing with this, the first thing is definition. What is it? Well, what it is a particular item that doesn't conform to the specifications for all of the other items that are being manufactured that are identical. So, to take our ladder that Pat fell off, or almost fell off, or may fall off in the future, if the problem in the ladder was that a supplier of it's a wooden ladder, by the way, a supplier of the rungs, the manufacturer of the ladder, isn't really a manufacturer, they're an assembler. So they buy like the pegs that are going to be the rungs that you stand on, and they buy the rails, and they really just put it together. Maybe drilling holes. But they're an assembly. And a lot of manufacturers, you realize, are assembly. Rather than actually starting from raw metal or mining products and going all the way up the chain. So they buy sub-compartments and put them together. Well, it just so happens that the wood that they got for the rungs was a wood that had some flaws in it. Now, you couldn't see the flaws. Think like knot holes in pine. Though it's not pine, but think of knot holes. Except instead of being visible on the outside, it actually was inside the piece. So it looked perfect on the outside, but it really was very weak because of this hole in the material which no one could see. Right? So the manufacturer uses these rungs, and it's one of those defective rungs that Pat stepped on when he starts to lose his balance, right? Now, assuming for this purpose. He loses his balance. He falls. He's hurt. And he sues the ladder company. He's in great shape, other than his physical injuries, because he can show that the wooden rung that broke did not conform to the specifications of the company. And therefore, they used the wrong kind of rung. And it was weaker. And that difference, the weaker, is what caused the injury. And we call the weaker rung the defect. So it's the defect that caused the injury. The defect caused the injury. Now, because the product is different than all the others, the proof of the fact that it was a defect simply comes by comparing the amount of weight that the normal rung would hold with the amount of weight that this flawed one holds, and therefore you have something that doesn't fit specifications. That's a manufacturing defect. Easy to prove. And by the way, sometimes you can't really tell what happened when you're trying to prove this manufacturing defect, perhaps because everything burned up, including the ladder, which is why it was a wood ladder rather than a metal ladder. So now it's all gone, right? And you can't tell which is Speller versus C.S. Roebuck on 773. And this is where it's time to mention how many of these negligence theories that we've spent several months discussing and learning, many of these negligence theories are still applicable in the strict liability tort, product liability. They still apply. However, very often, their name got changed. And they have somewhat different contours, but the idea and the principles tend to be exactly the same. So, if the ladder burned up because when Pat fell, he was holding something that was combustible and it started a fire and the fire burnt the ladder, so we don't have any ladder left, or at least we don't have enough of any of the rungs left to tell which what and what happened. How can we prove that the ladder was defectively manufactured, that is, that it had a production defect? How are we going to do that? Lo and behold, yes. And that's called res ipsa. Absolutely right. So good old res ipsa from negligence can be used in a production defect case to show that the reason the refrigerator burned or the reason the ladder broke must have been that something was wrong with this one, because if something hadn't been wrong, it wouldn't have happened. That's res ipsa, isn't it? And clearly, what happened is exclusively in the custody and control of the defendant, the manufacturer, and theoretically in the direct custody and control of the retailer, because we decided it is, even though they can't do anything. And therefore, you can use res ipsa to show a manufacturing defect. By the way, notice it's to show a manufacturing defect, not a warning defect, not a design defect, a manufacturing defect. Yeah? Oh, I thought it was a question. Okay. Now. Yes?
How did you say that it was in exclusive control if one of the ladder was standing?
Because it's the inside of the rung that broke. And we're going to have to call an expert, correct? Just like in any other res ipsa case. And in this case, the expert is going to say, well, here's Pat, you know, weighs 150, 60 pounds or whatever, and there's Pat, and there's the ladder. There's no way the ladder they make is going to break the way Pat said it broke, causing the fall, unless something was wrong with the rung.
or maybe the gluing, maybe it came apart, whatever it is, when we have an expert. Just like in the case in the book, the Speller case, you have an expert who comes in. This is a simpler expert, correct? But you're absolutely right. For recipes that to apply, you have to eliminate plaintiff's conduct. You have to eliminate the fact that he didn't saw it halfway through or something like that. And you do that because, of course, Pat's alive and don't tell us, I just miss you using it in a normal way. Now, this leads to, if you will, the most important discussion in this tort. It's this idea of a defect. Now, in a manufacturing case, a defect is a difference between the way the product should have been made, according to the manufacturer, and the way this particular one was made. And then that difference has to, of course, the injury. But let's change it a little bit. Let's say that it's a car, and it's a Volvo. Are they the safest car, supposedly, Volvo? Yeah. So Volvo designs some support under the car. And because they're the safest and better car, they design it so it's 50% stronger than the same item that you would find in any other car. 50% stronger. Now, it just so happens in the one Pat got, because of a manufacturing flaw, it's only 25% better than in any other car. Everybody get the idea? So instead of being 150% as strong, it's only 125% strong. Now, we find out what happens in this accident, and we find out that if the beam had been 150% as strong, if it had been as it was supposed to be, nothing would have happened. So, Pat sues, claiming that there was a defect. It's different than it was supposed to be. The difference caused the injury, you're strictly liable. Okay. Now we deal with this idea of what's a defect. The attorney's representing the manufacturer looks at the restatement and says, this second restatement here says that a defect is something that has to be unreasonably dangerous. Defect unreasonably dangerous is page 753. No, that's the third, I'm sorry. This is 749 for the second. Sells any product in a defective condition unreasonably dangerous. Defective condition unreasonably dangerous. Now, the restatement says, three, it's a defective when it contains a manufacturing defect, a defect in design, or an inadequate instructions or warning. And they're really clear on the manufacturing part here, departs from its intended design, correct? They then define B and C when there's a reasonable alternative. But notice that even in B, on page 754, you have this not reasonably safe verbiage. Everybody see that? 754, which defines what they mean by a defect on 753, you get virtually the identical words as you get on page 748 in the second, which is unreasonably dangerous. Okay, everybody see that? Any question about that? Not reasonably safe is the new language. Unreasonably dangerous was the old language. Not a hell of a lot of a change. So the question becomes, what do we mean by this? Well, defendants initially said, and I'm going to use the second restatement language because the substance is the same. They initially said that, the defendants,
you have to do prove two separate things. This is defendant's argument. You have to write it down. Listen. Two different things. One, that there is a defect. And then after you show it's a defect, you have to show that that defect makes the product unreasonably dangerous. Everybody get the idea? The defect, unreasonably dangerous. The plaintiff's bar said, no, wait, that's not right. That's not right. If it's unreasonably dangerous, it is defective. In other words, unreasonable danger is the defect. So it's not two things you have to prove, it's only one. In other words, what you should do is you should say, defect unreasonably dangerous. One thing. Not a defect which is unreasonably dangerous. Defect unreasonably dangerous. So not unreasonably dangerous, it's not defective. And if it is unreasonably dangerous, it is defective, but it's not two separate things. It's only one that you have to prove. And the plaintiffs prevail. That is, the definition of a defect is something that makes the product unreasonably dangerous. So if it's unreasonably dangerous because of a particular something, then it's defective and you can sue in strict liability. But this leads to this problem, unreasonably dangerous, which is why I gave you the Volvo hypo. Volvo says, yes, this car you had was different from the other cars that we make. And yes, the different caused your injury, but the car you got cannot be considered unreasonably dangerous. Why? Safer than every other car that's made. Every single other car, other than Volvo's, would be less safe than this, because remember, this one's 125% as strong. So the others would be, what, 20% weaker? I mean, this is still safer. And by the way, an aside, there's a separate tort for a violation of an express warranty. We promised you something. And so he's going to say, this is an aside. Well, you promised me the safest car made. And we said, yup, see, 125% is the safest car made. So, is the difference here something that's unreasonably dangerous? Correct? Everybody see the argument on both sides? Any question about the argument? It's different, but since it's not unreasonably dangerous, it's not a defect. And since that has never happened, we don't actually have a result, but you'll have arguments on both sides. It is different than what you intended to sell me, and the difference caused the injury, therefore it's a defect. That's not, that caused the injury, and for manufacturing tort, that's all, manufacturing defect, that's all I need. The other side said, the product itself has to be unreasonably dangerous. Okay, any questions about this? That's the manufacturing tort. That one's the easy one. We now get to this design defect. Now, this is repetition, but the repetition is important. Here I am, I'm the manufacturer now. And I sit here, and you know something? It really isn't my goal that people are going to buy my product and after using it for a couple of months, go to emergency rooms because they're hurt. I mean, if nothing else, that's not good for business, right? So that's not what I have in mind. So as I'm busy deciding how to design the product that I'm going to manufacture and sell, I am concerned that it's not going to cause a lot of injuries to people. But here's my problem. What I've decided to sell is kitchen knives. Steak knives and kitchen knives. And the reason I've decided to sell these, and it's really the kitchen utility knife I'm interested in, but because of the nature of this novel and special design I have, they're really good for steak knives too. So we're going to put out a little fancy handle for the steak knife, but otherwise same thing. And what I have here is a product in which the sharpness will not change with use. The only thing that could
change the sharpness of the edge is in some way, if you actually broke off, you know, made a hole in it in some way. But it just can't be made less sharp. Period. And we have a lot of knives, by the way, that stay sharp forever, but they tend to be stainless steel and not all that sharp, so this is really going to be a good one. And it's not going to rust. It's a new product. But here's my problem. It's a sharp knife. People cut themselves when they use sharp knives. Correct? And I have this problem because what I'm trying to do is figure out how people are going to use the product. You know? And I'm a little worried because once it starts to get old, I figure people will think it's less sharp than it used to be. And so maybe it's going to be considered dangerous. Maybe a product that doesn't get less sharp is dangerous because people will use it as though it's less sharp. I have no idea. And then it just so happens that there's something else. We've designed this to look the best. And we want the handle to be something sturdy and easy to grasp, but it can't be huge and bulbous like these rubber things. It doesn't look good. It's a fit right in this market. It's sort of, you know, it looks real expensive, but it isn't, and it lasts forever, but it has to look great. Just so happens, and we never noticed this, that the knife we're selling is perfectly balanced in the sense that it can be used as a knife to throw and will be balanced really well to throw. So I get this guy who buys it, I don't know, Pat, right? And he's busily throwing it at the tree and he thinks he's really good. So he has his friend to stand there, whoop, and you know. And I'm sued by the friend who stood there like an idiot while Pat threw a knife at him. And of course, I mean, he'll try to sue Pat, but there's consent if it's an intentional tort. And then, of course, Pat said, I didn't intend to hit him, so it's only negligent. And if it's negligent, he was contributorily negligent in agreeing to do it. Got all that stuff? It's called review. Right? So the thing is, let's sue the manufacturer. Well, what's the defect unreasonably dangerous? Right? You're going to sue the manufacturer because none of this would happen except for the fact that he designed the knife in such a way that... fill in the blank. That what? Come on. I told you the facts. That what? What?
It doesn't get dull.
No, it doesn't get dull doesn't matter. I mean, you threw almost any knife with a point. Well, wait. Somebody else. Yeah. That's right. That he designed it in such a way that it was perfectly balanced and therefore could be thrown. And see, this is an attribute of the design because it easily could have been designed a little bit differently so that it wouldn't be so well balanced. Now, of course, you can throw any knife, but the reason that Pat is throwing this one is it's so well balanced, it really works terrifically. So the fact that it is designed in such a way that it was perfectly balanced for throwing causes Pat to throw it, and therefore this other jerk who's standing there with Pat gets hurt, and he sues, saying that it's the design flaw, that it should have been designed that way. And they're saying, you see, that this is unreasonably dangerous to have a kitchen knife balanced so you can throw. And the reason this is important, because, you see, once they put this reasonableness word in it, and reasonable is there in the second, and reasonableness is there in the third restatement, correct? We now claim, in the second, that we're looking only at the product itself, to see whether the product is designed in such a way that it's too dangerous, meaning unreasonably dangerous. And that it doesn't matter how hard and long I thought, and that no one else in my position would have ever thought of this balanced throwing knife business. In other words, a reasonable person
who is in my position as somebody deciding how to design a knife to sell it, would not perceive or should not perceive of a danger based on how it happens to be balanced, the handle and the blade part is balanced. Therefore, I wasn't negligent. No, supposedly, we don't look at that.
We look at the product itself. Kessler's out of the picture. Is this product a product that's unreasonably dangerous? Without regard to the thought and intention I put in it.
And once we start thinking of it that way, we have a problem. And we have a problem because, I'm sorry, Pat, but, you know, we got idiots like Pat. I mean, here I am selling kitchen knives and spending days and days trying to figure out how to make the thing look good so people will buy it. And I'm supposed to think of this guy who's going to throw them and at some absolutely inane friend who's going to stand there. And I'm like, I have to think of this? In other words, as soon as we put in the word reasonableness, and whether we focus on whether I, as a personal human being, should have thought of it, or whether in analyzing the dangers of the product, we ask whether or not the world should have thought of it, doesn't really matter. Because the question now is, when you have this nice, snappy new kitchen knife that's about to be sold, would anybody in the world possibly imagine in the slightest way, including anybody who bought it, that it had some kind of danger? That means it should have been signed differently. So how do you tell whether a danger is an unreasonable danger or not an unreasonable danger? And we have several tests that we apply. And the first one is, if you will, the easiest. The consumer expectation test. So, I buy a knife, I expect it to cut. If I cut my finger, well, consumers have to have a modicum of intelligence and therefore have to know that if it's sharp enough to cut a steak, it's sharp enough to cut the somewhat similar meat in your finger, your hand. And if you decide to play mumbly peg with a knife, anybody not know what mumbly peg is? Put your hand on the table, spread your fingers, and go boom, 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 to see how fast you can hit in between. You know, and because it has a very sharp point, I cause a lot of damage. We can say, well, you know, I can't, and this is important, I can't design a knife that's sharp without enabling somebody who's stupid enough to play mumbly peg with it to be hurt. So, if you look at what consumers expect, when consumer buys a sharp kitchen knife as a sharp kitchen knife, do they expect that if they play mumbly peg and miss and hit their finger, they're not going to be hurt? I think the answer would be no. So, the knife that's so sharp that when you play mumbly peg you get hurt does not violate the consumer expectation. On the other hand, if I'm busy using the knife, and it's a metal tang all the way through with a nifty wooden handle, and when I press down hard, the wood shears off, and the metal inside, instead of being nice and round, happens to be sort of shaped in a, somewhat sharp at the top of bottom, right? In a wedge kind of shape. And even though it's not sharp, but it's narrow enough of a point so that when I press that hard and the wood breaks, it lacerates that old nerve again. Well, you could say consumers don't expect that the internal parts of a knife are such that if you push down real hard and it breaks, you're going to wind up with the metal handle deeply lacerating your hand, creating nerve damage. So, it violates consumer expectations. But, we'll take a short break. And after that, I mean, okay, it violates the consumer expectations. But in a lot of circumstances, consumers either don't have expectations, or the consumer expectation can't be determined by reference to a standard reasonable person reflecting what you or I might do. Because remember the guy who walks down the street and sometimes has drunk a few too many? Well, normal consumers who use products sometimes use them when they have drunk one too many, or when they're distracted, or when they're not paying attention and they don't carefully think it through. So maybe the consumer expectation test isn't enough. So we'll come back. We're going to talk about the difference between intended uses and unexpected foreseeable uses.
I don't like that. Still responsible for everything in that region, like, or just stuff he went over.
I'm not.
Reasonably dangerous or not reasonably safe, and therefore defective. And in dealing with this, one standard is what I call the consumer expectation standard. I design a product so that the consumer can use it the way they're supposed to use it, safely. Okay, and that's where I have to be. So if I design it to meet this expectation of the consumer, I can't be sued. It's not defective. It's not just sharpness of a knife. It isn't a problem. But here we have this, if you will, unusual use of the knife that we're discussing. So let's step back a moment and look again at that ladder that Pat fell off. Now he fell off. And which the rung broke, which is why he fell off. And let's now talk about why the rung broke. Wooden ladder, correct? Now, the ladder manufacturer, just like when I was a knife manufacturer, I have to sit there and I have to say, how strong does the ladder have to be? Strong means how much weight does the ladder have to hold? So I figure, okay, ladders are going to be used, this is like a 10-foot ladder, by one person at a time. I mean, that's what ladders are used for, right? You go up, you go down. Okay, that's fine. So, one person. So, what I have to do is I have to figure out how much that person weighs and how much they could be carrying. Okay? And then, by the way, I have to make the ladder stronger than that, correct? Because there has to be some margin of error, right? And now the next thing, you notice the Winnegar case with the bulletproof vest? Well, I sell different kinds of ladders. I sell my cheap ladders, my middle class ladders, and my expensive ladders. Okay? Now obviously, if I sell a cheap ladder, it's going to be made more cheaply than my expensive ladder, otherwise there's no difference, correct? I mean, you don't really sell ladders because of the aesthetic beauty of the ladder, right? Difference in price tends to be difference in sturdiness, difference in length of time it's going to be usable before it starts to wear, to break, to wobble, whatever it may be. So I figure, okay, people gotten heavier than they used to be. So let's say somebody might weigh 250 and go up on a ladder. And then let's look at what they could be carrying. That roofing thing I told you about comes in 90-pound packages. So I figure, okay, a guy who's 250 can have a 90-pound package. So altogether, he's weighing less than 350. Right, so if I make a ladder that holds 400 pounds, great shape, right? But here's what happened. And you know, Pat, you don't mind me telling people this? So it's okay. Pat used to have a real eating disorder. And he was an awful lot bigger than he is now. And as you may know, people who have weight problems very often tend not to weigh themselves all the time. I mean, you know, I know I'm very, very skinny because I don't eat anything. But I don't want to know that I'm now 84 pounds. You know, I mean, I feel fine. And people who, on the other side of an eating disorder, get very big. I mean, you know, what do you want to do? Stand on the scale all the time. Makes you feel big. So don't weigh yourself. Well, Pat, in fact, had at one point weighed about 240. But time goes by, and he was really a little over 300. And he had a 90 pounds over 300. Like, it's really like now about 425 pounds. The manufacturer thought 400 was giving a big margin of error. So as he's climbing up the thing, the ladder breaks. No defect in the rung. Wasn't designed to hold somebody with that weight who is that total heavy when you put the two together. So he sues. And I say, well, look, everybody knows I have my cheap ladder, my middle-class ladder, and my expensive ladder, correct? If you know you're going to put a lot of weight on it, you should have bought more expensive ladder. I mean, the fact that you chose to spend $79 for a ladder rather than $250 for a ladder isn't my fault. So is this ladder designed for reasonable use? Is this unreasonably dangerous and therefore defective? Or is it reasonable to design it this way? Well, the question becomes, can I expect people to be aware of things like how much they weigh and to be aware of how heavy the thing it is that they're carrying and continuously put it together? Or must I expect that people are, I wouldn't say indifferent, but don't pay attention? So maybe that's a defective ladder. And I say to myself, you know, but this is fortunate for me, it's before it happened. I'll put a notice on the side of the ladder. Right? And by the way, what should my notice say? How much weight? 350, maybe even 300. Well, 200. 325, right? Not the use over 325. And let's assume, by the way, that Pat saw this. But, you know, he figured he weighed about 260. He didn't really look at this as a heavy package, but it's not that heavy. He wasn't paying attention. Do I have to predict that people
are going to use this ladder, even though if they were thinking carefully, they wouldn't do it. So I have to design it on the theory that people, they're not going to not pay attention, but they're not going to pay attention to things like 225. And let me give you some of the things that have happened. Woman, about 5'1", is in her kitchen. She wants to get something from a cabinet, and the cabinet is over the oven. You know, it's a combined oven, stove top, oven, one thing. And there's nothing around to stand on. She's only 5'1", it's high. So she opens the oven door and stands on the oven door. Now, she's not a big woman. She only weighs about 115 pounds. But the oven, when she stands on it, tips over, falling her backwards, where she has serious spine injury, as well as having her legs crushed when the oven door snapping closed in her legs causes her a lot of injury. Now, when she sues me claiming it's defective, I say, you're a schmuck. What do I have to do? Design it for some idiot to use it? I lost that suit. And I should have lost that suit. And why did I lose that suit?
Sunoco.
Remember I told you? They don't go away, the same principles apply. All right, so the question is, when the product is being designed, does the product have to be safe if somebody uses it as a step stool? Well, the question becomes, where is it going to be placed? The kitchen. What's in kitchen? Shelves and cabinets. And indeed, even though in the modern American home, in a, you know, private house, the tendency is to put a window, not to put cabinets over the stove, because you have this big towel and a bed. Cabinets over the stove after a reasonable height of pots is perfectly ordinary, especially in apartments. So you got to know the cabinets there. You got to know that people aren't all that tall to reach them. And therefore, when you pull this thing out, looks like a step to me. And therefore, even though I don't expect subjectively the person to do this, even though logically it is not probable that a person would use it, would do this, once you look in the setting in which this is positioned, it is something that somebody might do who isn't thinking carefully. Now, the fact that it's something that somebody might do if they aren't thinking about it means that this has a danger if it's going to tip over and whack them on the ground, right? So the next question when we're dealing with design defect is whether or not it could have been designed differently to avoid this. And indeed, there are three different things that could have been done. One, the door breaks off. Right? I mean, how much can anything be in there? Anybody ever see a 50-pound turkey? No, I mean, so 50 pounds or more, the door breaks. Fine. Wouldn't tip over, wouldn't hurt it, correct? Number two, screw in. Right? Screw it into the wall behind, it's not going to tip over. Right? Three, counterbalance. So it's weighted in the back in such a way that if you step on it, it's not going to fall over. Of course, if Pat does and it's only counterbalanced, you know, at 325, it's going to fall over. But you can't do everything. So there's three design things that could have been done. Next, are these design things that could have been done so outrageously expensive that it would make the product not sellable? You could do it, but then you wouldn't have a stove, because nobody could be able to afford a stove. So it's not a choice between how to design it, but it's a choice between no stove or stoves. Everybody gets it, it's too expensive. It's like you could make cars that are dramatically safer, but the cheapest one would cost $85,000, and then it really wouldn't be a car anymore.
in terms of alcohol and the use in society. And the answer to that, of course, is it's not hard at all to mount it in such a way that it's screwed in. It's not hard at all to make the door that falls off. So it is an attribute design that caused this. No one sitting there before they put the item in the stream of commerce would have thought that some person, kid, whatever, would stand on it. But once they do, it's, well, you know, that's something that could happen. Not that the designer was wrong in not thinking of it, but it's something that could happen. Okay, different kind of thing. It's a long time ago, real long time ago. And there I am, a girlfriend's coming over to my apartment and like anticipating a romantic evening. And it would be really nice, just candles, okay? And I got some candles, and I light the candles, and one of us says something about scented. Oh, it should be scented. Oh, that night. And I said, well, you know, I didn't think of that one. And she said, oh, I have some perfume here. And I said, oh, that's good. That's great. So, I pour a little perfume on the candle, light it, right? Because it's mostly alcohol. Boom! Serious burns. Hey, it's not funny. She had really serious burns. This, by the way, is also a real case. They went to Yale. So, anyhow, you got these serious burns. And what we are, when we're dealing with this idea that I'm talking about a foreseeable unintended use or a foreseeable unexpected use, we're right back in good old Cicone oil in that laboratory where you got to figure there's a chance that the chemistry person will use a mislabeled item for something, right? Well, what they do here is they say, is this unreasonably dangerous? Well, it depends upon, first of all, which person are you suing? What entity are you suing in my hypo? Who are you suing? Right next to Pat. Come on. Yes, the perfume maker. Absolutely right. Suing the perfume maker. And what's the flaw? What? No. The flaw is going to be that there was no warning. Remember I told you product can have a danger, but maybe the danger isn't so dangerous? Well, you can't have perfume without alcohol in it, apparently. It has to evaporate, it has to this. You got alcohol. So, they really couldn't have perfume, but they could tell you, right? Just like Cicone. You know? Artificial or something like that. They could say, flammable. Well, maybe inflammable. So, there was no warning. So the question becomes now, is this unreasonably dangerous? And this case is not a new case at all. And the court said, well, yeah, of course it could be. That is, people who use perfume, unaware of the fact that it's flammable, could indeed be in danger. How? Anybody not know where a vanity table is? Everybody knows where a vanity table is? You don't know? So everybody knows. Okay. Person can be sitting at the vanity table, putting on makeup, candles to make it look nice, and open up that perfume bottle, and it might be so close to the flame that it would burn. And therefore, you see, somebody in the sort of foreseeable use of the perfume could have been injured in the way these people were injured, and therefore, it's a what I'll call foreseeable unintended use. Now, in doing this analysis, we have brought in, if you will, this notion of foreseeability at a very marginal amount. We have, in effect, chicken hawks in considering what is a foreseeable and an unforeseeable use of the product. Is there any limitation to this idea of this foreseeable, even though unintended, use? This was a newspaper article, but I'm using it as a case. Grandma had this nice little poodle, and she poodle would go out, and you know, in the rain, the poodle would get wet. So she put the poodle in the oven to warm it up a little bit. That's what it said. Dry it out. Apparently no problem. Until the kids got her a microwave. Oh. Didn't turn out so well. Actually exploded. Traumatized. Real trauma. So she sues. And the defect in the microwave oven is going to be, there isn't a warning saying, don't put live animals in. So the question becomes, is this a, clearly it's an unintended use, but is it a foreseeable unintended use? Well, this one isn't. Right? I mean, you can't foresee that you're going to put your pets in the microwave oven and close the door. Even though she put them in the regular oven. Alright, now, that's what the Volkswagen case on 779 is about. It is about foreseeable unintended uses. And how you go about, that is how a product has to be designed so that it is not unreasonably dangerous. Now, this is not consumer expectation as the test. Because no one driving a car expects it to be safe if they smash into another car or a brick wall. I mean, that's not really our expectation. But the question is whether or not there are characteristics of a product which a manufacturer has to ensure are safe, even though the consumer has no expectation one way or other about them. We as a society have an expectation that the product is going to be safe for uses that we as a society perceive to be not totally unlikely. Foreseeable, though unintended. So, the Volkswagen case is, of course, the most obvious because you can't know anything about cars without knowing that they get into lots and lots of accidents all the time. And if the car is designed in such a way that it's more dangerous when there's an accident, then it has to be when there's an accident. And this is called the second collision, by the way, when you smash into things inside of the car that cause you injury. Things, by the way, that in the cars you have, you might not even expect. For instance, the opening handle is now flush rather than sticking out when you're inside the car because you could, your head could come in contact with this handle sticking out. The steering wheel and the angle of the steering wheel and the way the steering wheel is constructed is that it's not rigid, so that it'll collapse so that if there's a front-end impact and the front of the car comes at you and it's not so severe that, you know, everybody isn't obviously turned into little particles, the steering wheel will collapse rather than just come like a spear into the chest of the driver, etc., etc. Design making it safer for this unintended getting into accidents, but very foreseeable, should I call it, use or activity in the vehicle. Volkswagen says that they have to be designed in such a way to be safe, which is reasonably safe, correct, for this foreseeable unintended use of getting it into accidents. Now, the next case here they talk about, so what I told you here is, of course, we're back in what's foreseeable. We're back in foreseeable use, and we're back in dealing with very unlikely uses in determining whether or not they're foreseeable or not. Even though we're no longer talking about the mental state of the designer, if you're dealing with Restatement 2, but rather are talking about the product itself, and in jurisdictions that have changed from Restatement 2 to 3, we are now talking about negligence in design
But it's exactly the same thing. Except you're not yelling at the designer if you're using the second. You're just talking about whether this product is safe for these unintended but foreseeable uses. Any limitation? I love this one. This isn't true. This is a hypo in a case. The judge used. What happens if we're got up there on this ladder and what he's doing is he's trimming the trees with a power saw. And when he gets down from the ladder with the power saw, he sits down and, like, takes off his heavy work shoes, and he sees, gee, you know, my toenails are really long. So he decides to cut it with a chainsaw. It's handy. Well, is that a foreseeable unintended use? No. In other words, there are limits. That is, using a chainsaw to cut your nails, sticking the poodle, the miniature poodle, or a toy poodle, I guess, in the microwave, there are limits to the foreseeable but unintended uses, but this category is very, very broad. How about this? I design a bus. Okay? No bus. And the back of the bus, I realize, has been designed in a way that doesn't maximize the number of people who get on the bus, which is, you know, important. Buses are used to transport people, and if you can fit more people on the bus, that's better. So instead of having the seats going all the way back, after the rear door of the bus, I put the seats around the outside, everybody's facing in, there's a pole in the middle, and hangers around the edge so people can stand in this now open place. And many more people can now stand in the bus than if I had seats the traditional way. So this is increased ridership. It's terrific. Well, one day, somebody is sitting right here in the middle. Remember, the bus is going this way. No one's on the bus hardly. And the driver stops suddenly. I'm sitting in the seat. He's the pole. Boom! Right into the pole when the bus stops suddenly. With serious cranial injuries. And I assume saying it's defectively designed. So, can they put a pole in the middle there? Or is it sufficiently foreseeable that if people are sitting without seatbelts, of course, on buses, that a bus is going to stop suddenly, which would throw people who are sitting into the air and they might come in contact with the pole and be injured? Answer, yeah, the bus is defectively designed. Now, would you have thought of this? I'm very well intentioned, you know? Just like the person who designed the butterfly ballot in Florida in the election. I mean, that was supposed to be easier to understand. Turns out no one could understand it, but, you know, she tried real hard. So I tried real hard. But, you know, it's not negligence. Is that bus unreasonably dangerous? Doesn't violate consumer expectations. Everybody sees the poles there, but it's still in this foreseeable but unintended use that it's going to stop suddenly when there aren't a lot of people standing up. Somebody's going to be thrown out of the seat and therefore it could hit the pole. Yes?
Don't the benefits outweigh it, though? Because that's meant for people that are standing and hold on. If it's not there, then those people fly.
You got it, except, of course, can I have handles from the top?
In the middle, no.
Of course I can. I can put a bar and have handles. Sure I could. Of course I could. Hey, the bus isn't that wide. All I'm saying is point. So it's an attribute of the design. But this is nothing anybody thought of in advance. But once you think of it, and then you say, well, must the product be safe for this purpose? Okay, I got a hypo for you, which we'll deal with next time. Okay? This is now blurring from the design into warnings. Remember, if a product is designed with a danger, and we all know about it, we can put a warning in it like 350 or 325 is the weight. But the question is that good enough? So what happens if I make a new knife? The new knife is the sharpest knife that ever was made. And I sell it as the sharpest knife the kitchen you can buy. It is as sharp as a scalpel, surgical steel. Okay? Can I sell that? And by the way, what happens is somebody who's using it as a kitchen knife doesn't cut their finger but cuts off their finger because it's so sharp. But instead, it was the sharpest knife you could buy, surgical steel.
Did that take the danger and make it okay? Does 300 on the ladder make it okay?
If the puppy in the microwave occurred again, would it then be foreseeable? And would, you know, with that precedent, would you be able to?
Well, the question is now going to be, is it, now that you know, you can't design the product differently. So the question is a warning. And so we'll talk about that, whether or not you now have to put on a warning. And what about warnings and what makes it good and not good? Problematic. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on, folks. I'm sorry. One second. I have an opportunity for more people to make money in January. We need 10 people for the 7th. The 7th and 8th, Wednesday and Thursday, to be witnesses. This is for a program for legal aid defense attorneys, for actual lawyers, and you're going to be the police officers, defendants, friends of police officers in these hearings. You have to do both days, but it's $100 a day, just like the other ones. So that was the 6th. This is 7-8. Wait a minute. Well, I thought I brought something. Just for this purpose. Yes, that's fine. Name and...
I was just going back to the hypo with falling off the ladder. So, because you're the person not directly involved with the ladder, so that you really affect you, it's not the second. So, because you're the third person, is able to see the ladder from the top of the ladder.
It's foreseeable that if a run breaks, somebody's going to pull.
Right.
And if because of the run break, something unforeseeable happens, it's not unforeseeable in proximate cause terms.
Okay.
I mean, something's going to fall off the ladder, people down there are going to get hurt.
Now, economic
laws
doesn't apply.
No, because it only applies to the people involved in the original contractual relationship.
Okay.
They're trying to get more than the benefit of the
law. This is actually negligence.
Well, it would be negligence anyway, but the product liability can't be used to recoup the stuff that you didn't get as a result of your bargain.
Right.
So it's only for the contracted part.
But there's still strict liability now.
No. Wait, yes. Strict liability.
For the ladder.
For the Degas, yeah.
Right.
But not strict liability if the ladder itself.
Right.
That is very well done.
Right. Cool. The ladder itself is good.